Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampir, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings, warriors, and welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
Jorn.
I'm Javon.
And we are being joined by Kavura. Say hello.
Hello, everyone.
In case you were wondering, Kavura is joining us today because she is a part of the Xeno Legion, a part of CAG that includes non-Klingons. And we are also going to be looking at a Romulan-centered book today entitled Sword Hunt by Diane Duane, original series novel number 95, published in October of 2000.
When was the last one written before that book?
My understanding is it was about 13 years between the last one and this one.
Oh, wow. See, I don't know about your guys' copies, but I know a lot of book three comes with book four now, but I actually have them individually. And the first page or two was devoted to just kind of like editor notes saying that they understand that this isn't how the Romulan Empire ended up. And this is like a alternate timeline or alternate dimension where her Romulans are the Romulans and she's just going to carry forward like that's the way it is.
Yeah, there was there were several reviews of the book of this book that I read. That number one, people felt that the publisher Pocket Books had taken this and split it into two books to do a cash grab. But according to Diane Duane, this thing started out being 110,000 words. And so at that point, they decided to split it into two novels because it was just too long.
Well, I would have to agree with those reviewers because why else would you split it up into two books other than make double the money?
Unless the book is too long, I imagine there's probably a length that they want to reach.
It hasn't stopped Game of Thrones.
Nor has it stopped David Weber, where 110,000 words is an Honor Harrington novella.
Now, maybe it's different back then, but I've just noticed that if a book's really long, they just charge more for it.
Well, what I understand is that they, it had to do with like needing another book. I mean, they actually did have an open spot for Diane Duane to write two books instead of just one. So that's the reason they split it out. But it is interesting to note that because, as I'm sure everyone is thinking about this book, it really seems like they should have just gone on and made it one book because of the way this one ended. It just leaves you hanging. I mean, it's worse than other books where we know they're going to be continued. I mean, did everyone?
Yeah, as somebody who has
Yeah, I mean, like you all felt that way, right?
Oh yeah, as somebody who hasn't read the second, the fourth book, I should say, this book is not self-contained at all, which. It doesn't really normally bother me, but in these Star Trek books, sometimes it's a little bit jarring because you don't really expect it.
You never expect it with any book. And in this case, it's like, yeah, it just kind of, I mean, it's just there. And you're like, I mean, there wasn't even a big scene at the end or anything. It ended on a low note.
Yeah, it's not like it ended with a giant battle and you don't know what's going to happen next. It's just they get to the end of a meeting and it's like, well, that's it.
So for those of you that have the omnibus, where this one just continues into the next story, that would be a much better read, I'm sure.
Although it did get confusing to know where I'm supposed to stop for this review.
Now, I remember you guys telling me that this is more a sequel to the first book than is the second one, but reading it, I'd say it's a sequel to both of them, and I would even say the second one was a sequel to the the second one was a sequel to the first one. Even though it was only like one or two chapters, there does seem to be a continuing story. I found the ending going from book two to book three doesn't quite gel as somebody who read them fairly close together. But I imagine a part of that's just a little bit of retconning just so that she can tell the story.
And you're right, I looked it up. There was a 13-year gap between the Romulan Way and Sword Hunt.
So this one, it did bring up a lot of the previous stories to bring the reader up to date. So, I mean, yes, it does kind of depend on those first two books, because you do have to know, like, the character Array from the Romulan Way and how she started out as a Federation deep cover agent being sent to Romulus. And she is one of the characters in this book. And you do need to know some of the Romulan history, like the Romulan female tyrant of the past and how they don't want to repeat what she did. And of course, the Romulan commander, A.L., and how she and, you know, her past with Kirk and why she and her crew, like, seem to be so buddy-buddy with the Enterprise and their crew.
So I guess that brings up a point here. Could Sword Hunt have been shortened enough to allow it and Honor Blade to be combined into one book if there wasn't that 13-year gap and readers were more familiar with the concepts of what happened in those first two books to make up the continuing story that we're reading now?
I'd say yes and no. I'd have to read the fourth book to really have a solid answer on that, but I don't find there's too much retreading old ground. It's not like they gave us the entire history. Like, they did the normal retreading that you expect in a book that had been a series that had been dormant for a little bit. But even if they released these books back to back, I think there have just been as much retreading. It's just the story was a little big, and it should have ended with the battle that they had halfway through the book. They should have almost ended the book with that, or had a second attempt to do the Sun Seed, I think it was called.
Correct.
It probably would have been better to have the battle scene at the end. I mean, I'm thinking it must have been because they don't want the reader to stop halfway through the book if someone said, oh, this book is boring or something. So they put it in the middle of the book just to keep you in the book more.
Well, if it was for the fact that I already owned this and we were doing it for this podcast, I probably wouldn't bother reading the fourth book because I kind of found this book boring.
Well, before we get into our overall impressions of the book, let's have Jorn there read us the summary of the book, a.k.a. the blurb on the back cover.
The sword was the ultimate symbol of Romulan power, tradition, and pride. It laid in the Senate chamber of the Romulan Star Empire, revered and untouched for centuries, until the day that Dr. Leonard McCoy was tried for treason, and both were stolen during an attack on Romulus itself. Now, to avenge that insult and save face in the eyes of their deadly enemies, the Empire must recover the sword at any cost. Their envoys to the Federation demand the return of the sword and the extradition of the Romulan renegades who aided the Starship Enterprise in McCoy's escape. If diplomacy fails, the Romulans will trap the Klingons and Federation into open war. In such dangerous times, the Starship Enterprise is assigned the most valuable and volatile element of all, the fugitive Aiel and her stolen bird of prey, Bloodwing, and the sword they carry. Aiel will undoubtedly use the ship and sword to foil their enemies and play her hand in the dangerous game that she's begun. But she will do it all under the watchful eyes of James T. Kirk, the Federation captain, who knows her dangerously well. Boy, I've got a couple of problems with that synopsis. Number one, the Enterprise didn't go in and save McCoy. It was all on the Bloodwing. And when you start talking about a woman commander that James T. Kirk knows dangerously well, that's kind of a double entendre.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that assessment. Although, well, we'll get into that later. So how about Juvon, go ahead and continue with your opening, your overall impressions of the book.
I thought it was kind of boring.
Can you elaborate?
Unlike the second book, where yes, there was a lot of exposition, and it was alternating every chapter, and it helped break up the action sequences and the mystery and all that stuff. Where this was just a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff was happening. A lot of explanations of stuff that I didn't really need to understand. Like all them trying to explain how they're going to stop the sunseed stuff. Yeah, it's all made up anyways. I don't really need to understand it.
I thought it did get into the technical aspects a little too much. And since we were talking about how it, you know, the one book got separated into two, I do feel like this one had a lot of filler. The conversations, I mean, people talked a lot in this book, and it just went on and on. So for those things, I can understand. Yet you're reading it and you're thinking, well, I mean, they're explaining too much. They're talking too much. Some of it did seem like it was just there to make the book a little longer.
And I think some of the talking too much, technical descriptions of sunseed actually hurt a bit, because when they finally used sunseed and is being described, it kind of just sounded like what Worf's brother did in one of these Star Trek Next Generation episodes: dive into the sun, drop a photon torpedo in there, and blow away the three ships that were following him with a solar flare.
Yeah, it sounded like a needlessly complicated version of that. And on top of that, it didn't work like it was supposed to. So then they have to launch into a giant explanation of why certain stars work and some don't, which, again, doesn't really matter because it's all nonsense anyways. You could have said, oh, it's a dwarf star. It doesn't seem to work on dwarf stars. I'd be like, oh, okay, that's fine.
And in the series, you had Spock going in and Scotty going in and, okay, we're going to throw this equation in, and boom, it works.
I just could not get into this book fully. I read it about a month ago, and it is utterly unmemorable to me, except in that there are things I do remember, like the battle. That was really, really good. The other thing is the characters are very well written and fleshed out a lot, but the action in it just dragged along. And then we had the battle, and as I'm reading the book, I recall saying, wow, okay, now here we go. We're going to get a really great story. And then the battle was over, and we went back to this plotting, going along, and it really caused me to have a lot of problems holding my attention and wanting me to read on. It actually became kind of a chore for me.
Another thing they could have ended with besides a battle is that we were told an uprising was starting, but we don't see it. Like we see like the beginning of planting the seed in everybody's mind, and then we're just told later somewhere else on a ship, yeah, they're uprising.
And now I'm going to throw a curve at you guys, because I think there was an area in this first book, in this story, that should have been delved deeper. How did the house matron become a senator simply because of one heroic act? That transformation should have been gone into a bit more deeper to sell us on her rise to power from being a servant.
And I think this is a part of the retconning that I was referring to, is that in the other book, it was implied it was years that took her to get to a senator, where now it's just a couple of months, where they could have just had this book. She's these two books could have been kind of her journey to actually becoming a senator. The book just explains how, because the other guy's retiring or whatever, he decides to put her in charge for some bizarre reason. But there just should have been an explanation. Yes, you're right. This should have been elaborated on more than anything else in the book.
So how about you, Kavura, your overall impressions?
I liked some parts of it. Like you have mentioned, the science of the Sunseed Project, I didn't get into that as much. But as far as the characterizations, the relationships, I enjoy reading that part. And the adventure scenes, the Klingon raids, and the battle scene with the Romulan ships, I liked those parts. So, I mean, overall, I think I did enjoy the book. It's just that the most parts that dragged for me was about the Sunseed project. And also I do want to mention about the double entendre with Kirk and Aiel, also implied in this book. I noticed in two places, right? Because when Kirk was talking to her, and they were both kind of thinking, or one of them was thinking, like, that people might get the wrong idea about the two of them. And then it was also mentioned by the Klingons, when those three Klingons had that meeting, and it was mentioned, well, Kirk and this Romulan woman, they might be, it was hinted at in the book as well. And maybe they didn't really need that in the book, but then you might think, well, what else would people think besides that? Because maybe everyone really does know Kirk's reputation.
Well, you know, as I read the book, I remember a couple of higher Romulan officials referring to that they definitely thought that Aiel and Kirk were romantically involved also. And I read that and it's like, they're not romantically involved at all. But, you know, that it seemed like something like throwing some gasoline on the fire in order to inflame the Romulans more to want to get into this war, because as far as I was concerned, the Romulans are spoiling for a war with somebody.
And as far as the characters being well written, I had the feeling, it was never stated, but I had the feeling that if Kirk were to try his usual moves, she would have thrown him against.
Well, I also got the impression that she is much older than him, just because it was her niece that was the Romulan commander in the Enterprise incident. So it seems like this woman would be a generation older, so it just wouldn't be as appropriate for Kirk.
Well, yeah, we can't go with that, because when I was in high school, there was a family at the same school who had a classmate of mine whose uncle was just 1 year above us.
Okay, yes, it does happen that people, being nieces and nephews, you could really be the same age. It was just sort of the impression I got, but you're right. Age may not really matter as far as family members, and one may not necessarily be that much older than the other.
And how much older is Spock than Kirk, yet they look about the same? And Aiel is from basically the same stock, whereas I'm assuming that Romulans age at a different rate than humans do.
I had the impression that Aiel was a counterpart, the Romulan counterpart to Kirk. She was very inventive. She's very adaptable. She can think on her feet very, very quickly, and she can get a situation resolved when it needs to be done. I mean, just the Romulan version of Kirk.
Yeah, I kind of have that
captain.
That was one of the things that made that their friendship work, because they had so much in common as being leaders and being great people to their, like, great captains to their ships or commanders to their people. They were both creative and could think fast and could lead and care about their people and generate loyalty in their people. So that is one of the things that they were able to bond over.
So let's talk a little bit about how the Klingons are involved here.
They're talking. Well, of course they're raiding the Romulans, right? So we know that they are trying to get involved. And a lot of the book is about a potential war and how the Klingons will get involved if the Romulans and Federation go to war. And it looks like the Klingons were, they seem to me to be sitting back and still waiting for something to happen. But they do want to get involved. And then they do want their own power.
It seems like the Emperor wants these guys to keep on expanding, but the guys in charge of them, Khmer, he's fine with sitting back and waiting until the war starts, and then he can just start picking off settlements that nobody will miss in the middle of the war.
They are like picking off these small settlements, just getting what they can for now, and still waiting for the bigger battle.
And at this point, unless it pays off in book 4, all the Klingon stuff is just useless right now.
all of the talk, yes, was just set up, and it really makes you, I mean, to me, it makes me want to read the next book, because I do want to see what happens. And I do expect, I mean, I read it a long time ago, so it's hard to remember, but I expect the next book to be much better to complete the story.
What's difficult for me to separate is the way the Klingons and Romulans behave toward each other in canon. And in this book, it's a little bit different because you're wondering, okay, the Klingons have no use, well, not in the book, but in canon, the Klingons have no use for Romulans. They are totally without honor, and we don't even want them involved in anything up until Deep Space Nine, of course. But the Klingons don't like the Federation either. So are we working towards maybe a triangular war situation here, or are the Klingons going to come in on one side or the other?
It does seem like a three-way war. I believe in the first book, that's where it's established that the Klingons and the Romulans right now have a truce going on.
In fact, I think it was talked about here in Sword Hunt that the Romulans were looking at seeing which way the war was going to break out. Was it going to be them versus the Federation, or was it going to be the Klingons versus the Federation? And then the third party was going to come in and pounce on the decimated victor.
Of course, now, you know, as far as this three-sided thing is going, the Romulans, if you take the summary for what it means, the only thing they care about is getting the Bloodwing back, putting those people on trial, getting McCoy back and finishing up with him, and retrieving the sword. So the Romulans don't really care what's going on with the Klingons. But since the Federation is protecting the Bloodwing and AL and her crew, that's where the big conflict is.
I get the impression reading it that, yes, the general populace of Romulus might feel that way, but the three people who had that secret meeting don't really care. They just want war with the Federation, regardless of what happens.
I think those three Romulan praetors that kept meeting, they do want, what they want is power for themselves. And so it's however they can get it. And so in this case, they did say they were planning something. They had the, there was the meeting that the whole book was about, the meeting with the Federation and the Romulans. So it does look like, I mean, you know, that the Romulan government is what wants something. The book talks a lot about, you know, all the scenes with the Romulan civilians who really just want to live out their lives. They care about their families, and that's all they want. They're not into politics. But the government, and of course, as Ayel kept saying, the government is changing. They're, you know, because they seem to have left honor because the people in power just want more power for themselves.
Remember the Romulans that we're seeing being terrorized or attacked in their colonies are also, what is this ship clan? So we're also seeing a bit of discrimination going on within the Romulan society.
Now, those praetors that are wanting the war, they, you know, obviously, to me at least, they seem like the Romulan Illuminati, or the power behind the power that is pushing and pushing and pushing the powers that are visible in power to do what they want them to do.
And so they are after their own power, but also, they, as you said, they do want the sword back, and they do want AL. They things because it gives them more prestige themselves if they can retrieve these things that the AL and her crew and the sword that she took, and have Dr. McCoy back, and even Captain Kirk.
Well, they look pretty weak if they don't achieve these goals. These visible goals. I mean, we have a renegade Romulan ship from their point of view, and if they don't get this back, it doesn't even appear like they can control their own people.
Well, they can't. That's what the revolution is all about. Well, what did other people think of Arahia's elevation to Senate so quick?
I could buy it. I've seen weirder things happen. I think her being in the right place at the right time. I totally buy something like that.
I think it was put in the book to give her more power, because she was, you know, Arai started out as a servant, and in some ways it was to show how the way you can move up in Romulan society, maybe just by getting attention.
Well, didn't she do a lot to prove herself, just about, I mean, running a Romulan household for a high government official would get her noticed, and she was very well studied in everything she needed to do to become where she got to. I thought it was maybe kind of a natural step.
It probably helped that it didn't seem like he had anybody to pass everything on to. So when she kind of proved herself in the Senate building, you know, it's, you know, the move all the irons hot, or strike while the iron's hot type of situation.
Thing that she was chosen to go to the, the summit meeting with the Romulans and the Federation. That was a good idea, just to be, you know, saying that they chose her because she is new to the Senate, and she hasn't been bought out yet. I mean, that was a great creative move by the writer to put there for that reason. And maybe it was a setup by the writer, because in the previous book she was the main character, and so now we still want to use her and have her be important to the story.
And you had the logical hook there of she was picked because of her relationship with McCoy.
Which, just to go on a little bit of a tangent for a second, I the first book, maybe two, it was, you know, it's kind of funny that they're saying the wrong names all the time, pronouncing it weird. But in this book, they're speaking English, especially on the ship. They're speaking perfect English, but they still can't say their names properly.
It is interesting the way they did it, because you're reading the book and you can see the way they spelled their names. And yeah, the way when the Romulan says, you know, like Kirk, and they spelled it like K-R-R-R-K or something. Yeah, that was fun to read.
Oh, it didn't bother me when it was Romulans talking to Romulans in supposedly Romulan, but when the Romulans are on Enterprise and they're all speaking English, what's the point of that point? So they can say everything else perfectly, but they can't say McCoy.
I guess names are harder than words.
I actually found that bit quite amusing. Getting back to Array, though, you know, now she is in a very precarious position, being a Federation spy and a Romulan senator. Which way is her loyalty going to fall?
I still think she's going to stick with the Romulans, just because, I mean, she didn't want to go back home, to so-called home, when McCoy offered that to her. And so I think she really is trying to stay loyal. And if anything conflicts, I mean, I still think because she's still on the same side as AL, basically. But I still see even Arai being even more loyal to the Romulans than AL, just because Arai wouldn't have stolen the sword or done something like that. She wouldn't go totally renegade the way AL did.
So do you think maybe she's going to take a more conservative tack on trying to change the government from within and maybe avoid war and conflict?
I hope so, yes. She doesn't really have the power to make them go to war or not, but I think she would still be loyal to the Romulans as far as what she thinks is right, as far as avoiding war for as long as possible.
So then being a double agent may just avoid a bad situation getting worse.
One thing that always bothered me whenever she's in a scene is the concern she's got to have not to ever cut herself.
You mean like cut herself physically, or to not to reveal who she is?
To bleed. To bleed that red, not green blood.
Oh, yes. She has to be very careful not to, yeah, because that would be so obvious if it happened. And yeah, that you have to, like, what can you do about things like that?
Actually, there's a whole bunch of people that you can go to and get input on what they have to do. She has to act like hemophiliacs act. They can't ever cut themselves or get a bruise or do anything like that, because it's very hard for them to stop bleeding.
I think I have seen another story where someone had, they had some kind of fake blood that was like under their skin or something, but that was like because they knew they were going to be cut and they knew they had to bleed a certain color. But the things like that you could arrange just to avoid suspicion if anything came up.
And I know the author never mentions that particular thing, but in the back of my mind, as I'm reading her scenes, this is occurring to me. It's kind of a tension that I have with her character.
Now, see, I'm recalling a previous show that we did on this series, and I brought that same question up. I mean, what if she had to go to the doctor for an emergency situation? And if I recall correctly, Juvon had picked out something from one of the previous books that her physical makeup had been changed enough that there shouldn't be a problem with that.
Yes, I believe that was in the Romulan Way. Either McCoy or herself explained basically they opened her up and reorganized her insides to look Romulan and then gave her like a blood transfusion. She has to take pills or something like that to keep up.
I always thought she would probably have to have a doctor who knows her secret, though, just in case she really did get sick or something. Because if they looked at her closely enough, they would still know that she was a human in disguise.
That was one of the reasons why McCoy went in when he did, was they lost contact with their contact. And I think it came down to they theoretically should have ran out of meds around that time. And that was one of the reasons why they sent McCoy in particular, is that he could have helped her if she was sick.
Well, let's hope they didn't have to go to all the work that Discovery had to go to with, I believe it was Taylor, who was the Klingon.
Whoa! Spoilers! Spoilers!
Anyhow, you know what I'm talking about.
But it sounds like it was the same thing.
But oh, is he messed up.
Yeah, that guy was a wreck.
Well, there is the forced resettlement that's going on of the ship clan.
Yeah, let's go there.
No, they're going there. They don't want to go there. If they don't want to go there, there must be a reason they don't want to go there. So why should we want to go where they obviously don't want to go? Have I convoluted that enough for everybody?
Yeah, let's start over.
Okay, if they don't want to go there.
No. Not like that.
I think it's an interesting idea to have the forced relocation of the ship's clans, and then they start forcing them to build ships, you know, with no input from them, and basically train them like slave labor, because it does give a motivation for rebellion, which it does seem clear this story is moving in that direction, and you have kind of a built-in large group of people who can rebel, and there are also people with particular skills that would be useful to somebody, and you know, if those people go, other people might go with them just so that they can stay on those guys' side.
The people who are, you know, the ship clans, of course, they don't want to be moved. It's their home. They want to stay. But that is part of the unrest. And A.L. said that she has heard rumors of these things happening. She knows that there probably will be an uprising because these ship clans, these people are unhappy. And so that is one of the things the book focused on, showing us how these people are there. And Aiel knows about them, even though she only knows through rumor, but we, the readers, know that it is true.
Now, is there something about Romulan society that they're basically turning on the class of people that safely brought them to the planets they got to?
It must be that it just turned out to be other people who came into power. So the powerful people just want to get rid of the others who have just turned into more of the laborers of the people.
It seemed to me that there were two philosophical positions going on. There was the new Romulans who wanted to progress, and then another bunch of Romulans that wanted to break off and move more towards traditional values, even edging towards the good parts, as far as they were concerned, the good parts of Vulcan society?
There are basically, I mean, almost like the ones who want peace and the ones who want war. But basically, the ones who are the more traditional, who just need to, who want to do the farming and take care of their families, and then the others who are the political ones. And you know how Arai was saying, like, she, now that she's a senator, she's around like food all the time. Like, are they afraid I'm going to starve? And then you have the other people who have to work harder for their food.
And didn't we find out in the Romulan Way that one of the reasons these Vulcans left Vulcan to go out and found their own empire was because they were of the more violent bent that wanted to conquer their environment?
Well, they didn't want to give up their passion for the things that they felt mattered, like art and literature and being emotional. They were, I think it was more of a rebellion against the Sarek philosophy of purging emotions and not allowing yourself to be motivated by emotions, but by logic rather instead. But the Romulans that broke off and left didn't want to give up their emotion, and they felt like they no longer belonged at Vulcan because of this.
So it makes me wonder, did something happen to the pilots and engineers, aka the people of the ship clan, that made them start seeing life, the universe, and everything more in the Vulcan tradition than in the tradition that they left Vulcan for?
That is a good point. But I think in the Romulan Way, it does mention how they, because they spent so long on the ships when the Romulans left Vulcan, up with the upkeep of the ships and all, and then once they found a planet that they could stay on, they forgot about the ships and they just wanted to make a life for themselves on the planet, and it became more about building their culture on the planet. And they went through their period where they did develop their art a lot more, but now that they evolved since then, they've gone, you know, different ways with the different mentalities of the civilians and the military.
Well, why don't we move into favorite points of plot, or not so favorite points of plot as it may be. Javon, why don't you lead us off on this one?
My main not so favorite point of plot is that the book has no real self-contained story, and that is literally just the first half of a two-part book. So it ends on a very low note because they didn't rewrite the section to make it a little bit more exciting, or maybe write in the last chapter could have just been the start of the uprising. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, that's a interesting take on it. And I think that might have worked because I have to agree that it felt like setting up all the things to make the second half work. And the biggest memorable part of this first book, the attack of the seven Romulan vessels on the Bloodwing and the Enterprise, while it was interesting for a little while, didn't have enough of a payoff to satisfy.
And Kavura?
For me, what was most interesting was seeing Array on the ship. It was going to meet with the Federation, and she was there, and there were other, she found other conspirators there. The one that the other female that pulled her aside and said, I'm giving you a package. And then the other, the one from the Romulan Way that met with her and seemed to kiss her, but he was giving her some secret data chip. I like those little covert things like that. But as far as the overall book, you know, we really couldn't, like, we didn't really have to worry about giving away spoilers because there really were none in this book. It was more like an intro to the next book. So I do look forward to reading the next book and seeing, you know, the real action and the real meat of this story.
And as far as spoilers are concerned, I think the books were published, boom, boom, a month apart.
Yeah, so that would have been better to read them one after the other, yes.
Well, I guess my favorite points of plot were the battle in space was really good. I kind of enjoyed myself the scientific explanations and the way they talked about the sun seed in order to get things going. I would have liked to have had more of a Ray's story in this book, a little more focusing on her. As a matter of fact, I would have enjoyed if we had had more of a focused point of view from somewhere, because the book to me just bounced all over the place. You get a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I think maybe there was just way too much going on, and it wasn't exciting and it wasn't engaging enough to keep me wondering what was going on next.
Yeah, at least she didn't bounce point of views within a particular section. You did have a gap, a line gap, to let you know when she was going to shift points of view.
Yeah. Okay, how about our closing thoughts? And I guess I just kind of move that in with favorite points of view. Instead of closing thoughts, why don't we do this? What is going to happen, or what should happen in the next book, that would make this more of a complete story, or something that we would be way more interested in reading?
I'm going to have to defer judgment on this, because the first time through I read both books together. So while I'm going to have to reread them again for when we do a podcast on Honor Blade, I do have an idea where the stories go.
I guess I'll go, because I haven't even read the first book, the fourth book at all. I hope there will be a rebellion. I imagine that the whole space seed setup thing will pay off in the war, that maybe they'll use it against the main fleet or something like that. I imagine the Klingons are going to turn against the Romulans for some weird reason, or otherwise that's going to be one hell of a war, but this is alternate timeline, so who knows how that'll go. And I imagine that the double agent now is going to probably stick with the Romulans, or otherwise she would have left last book. Other than that, I think all the key good guys will probably survive, and the sword will probably end up back in the Senate, and either the Federation spy who's a senator will be the new Praetor, or Ale, or however you pronounce it, will be the Praetor instead.
Well, I did read the next book, but it was so long ago that I don't remember much about it. So I'll just conjecture that I would think the next book should have, I mean, you know, it'll end with a big battle scene against the Romulans in Starfleet. Probably someone of honor will be put in power over the Senate and the Praetors. I don't think it would be any of the main characters in this book. I think A.L. will probably, like, her honor will be restored, and she'll be able to be a regular commander in the Romulan fleet again. And Arai, I think she will stay on Romulus and continue to succeed as a senator.
Now, I'm going to say, as I said earlier, that all-out war is going to be avoided. I agree that there's going to be a big battle in here somewhere coming up, but it's going to be a limited battle that is going to probably purge the government of the more hawkish members. They'll be exposed and thrown out of power, and I think that the others will come in, take over power, and we'll get a, excuse the term, kinder, gentler government, or at least a more reasonable government.
Here's a monkey wrench to throw into this discussion that I don't know if it was addressed. If it was, I overlooked it, but how did the Federation know how to surgically doctor their agent when in the original series, they first of all had never seen a Romulan before, and then secondly only met them in the third season of the final show?
Might have been an extension of learning how to integrate medicines of other species, because at this point they would just essentially be Vulcans, and maybe for some bizarre reason they had already figured out how to transplant organs from Vulcans to humans or something weird like that.
In my mind, the bottom line is the books are not canon. And so the author was authorized, not authorized, but did what she felt was going to be right based on the information that she had. And it almost, I mean, we even have a different name for the people. They're the Riansu, not necessarily the Romulans. And so to me, canon and non-canon have taken two different tracks, and you might even call it an alternate universe thing.
I'd like to see them try this a little bit more often, where you take a book that was popular, but it's clearly out of continuity now, and just let the author run wild and do whatever they want. What happens next in this alternate universe? Because as much as I've harped on this book, I imagine the payoff will be in the second half. And in hindsight, I'll appreciate the third book a lot more.
Well, do not forget, there is a fifth book, so the payoff may come there.
Well, it kind of makes sense that if you take a book and split it in two, if it was intended by the author to be one complete story, and then you chop it in half, and you don't very, very carefully rewrite the end of the first or the first volume before you split it, it would be quite unsatisfying. Which makes me, I'm wondering what our rating of this book would be. And I am going to give this 2.5 out of 5 sun seeds.
I think it, now knowing that the two books were released a month apart, I appreciate that much a little bit more. I would have been a little bit more, I guess, put off if they'd been released like 6 months or just anything came out. If it was any longer apart, I probably would have been a little bit more disappointed. But I actually abstained from giving this a review because it's only half a book. So I don't see the point in giving a score until I read the other half.
And I'm afraid I'm with Javon on this. We'll have to wait and see what Diane does with the second half with Honor Blade before we can pass judgment on.
Which is funny because going into it, I was like, oh, it'd be interesting at the end of the podcast to ask everybody to rank the three books, and then we'll see how that changes with the fourth one. But I wouldn't rank this book on its own. I would have to rank it with the fourth one.
Because if you stop and think about it, yeah, it's two books, but it's one novel.
I also think that when she had to separate the two books, and a time constraint, and that's the reason she wasn't able to rewrite the first one, at least not as much as she wanted to. But as far as ratings, I still had something in mind. I was going to give this one a 3 just because that's just how I feel. Even though, I mean, some parts of the book were good. It was not as good as the first two books in this series. And I'm sure the rating would be higher if I could rate this one with the next one.
And that's perfectly understandable.
Now, next time, once we read the book, it would be interesting to go back and rate them as a whole, then rate them individually. But until I read the second half, I don't feel comfortable giving a rating at all.
All right, fair enough. Then we will not give this an overall rating until we read the second one. However, I'm going to submit to you that this book did not inspire me at all to want to read the next one. So most likely, I probably would not have gone ahead and gotten the next book in the series.
I agree. I believe I said as much earlier that if I hadn't already owned the second book, I probably wouldn't have bothered. But definitely, because it's definitely, I'm reading this at all because we're doing it for the podcast.
All right. Well, about all we can say is stay tuned, because the next time we look at the fourth Riansu book, we'll be probably dovetailing these two episodes.
Or if we don't, you, gentle listener, can.
Yeah, there you go. All right, then. So, Javon, what are we reading next?
We are reading Star Trek Prey, Book 1, Hell's Heart, by John Jackson Miller.
And that is set in the Next Generation era, isn't it? But it involves a familiar character.
In fact, this is going to be the most recent book we've read. This is at least my editions from the 50th anniversary line. And it's past kind of Star Trek Destiny for anybody who's aware of that one, and it's well into the relaunch era.
Yes, I read this book I think sometime last year, so it'll be nice to revisit.
It'll be interesting to go from a very recent one and see how much everything has changed over the years.
It will. So anyway, Kavura, I want to thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me. It was great fun once again.
And despite the fact that you're the Romulan representative from the Xeno Legion, I understand that the last alien race you portrayed at conventions was rather blue.
Oh, yes, the Andorians. Those are so much fun. It's a great cosplay.
Especially with the information, the background that you can draw from Star Trek Enterprise.
Yes, and I did a panel on Andorians at Starbase Indy last November, and I did draw a lot from Enterprise when I did the panel because they developed the Andorians so well on that show. That was just about one of the only things I liked about that show.
I remember from the original series, you had Andorians being kind of. But then you get to Enterprise, and they're an actual warrior race.
Yeah, that's what was fun. They were warriors, and because they were the enemies of the Vulcans, and so it kind of helped us see more about the Vulcans, too.
So, if you don't mind, I'm going to shamelessly plug Kavura and Nayar's podcast, which launched not too long ago, called Star Pod Log, which I've listened to all your releases. I am thoroughly enjoying that. I'll tell you what, they're full of nostalgia, and it brings back a lot of memories, what you talk about on that podcast. I really enjoy it.
Jim, we both know that you're only doing that because both you and I have been on that podcast.
Now. We've only played a very small part of a much larger picture that they are painting on that podcast.
Well, I do want to thank both of you for being guests on the podcast. We enjoyed having you, and we also hope to have Juvon someday. And also, we started a new podcast called Star Pod Trek, which is just about Star Trek, and so we hope you all tune in for that as well.
Well, I know Jim and I's participation on it was awfully sandy.
Oh, sand as in dune? Yes.
Yeah, but we've tried to get it as spicy as possible.
Okay.
Oh, I'm blue-eyed with envy. No, I'm just kidding. All right. So
you're getting in the mood now, Jim.
Yes.
We should put links to your guys' episodes in the description.
So, Juvon, why don't you tell folks how they can get in touch with us if they so desire, and where they can find us, and so forth and so on?
Well, the easiest way to get a hold of us is to send us an email at podcasts@keg.org, or they can find us on pretty much any social media platform. So just put Keg Podcast in and search it. I mostly check the emails, and I'm on Facebook often, so those are probably the two best ways. People can send reviews of books if they want in, and I can either audio or written format, and I'll start adding them to the tavern if they ever start showing up. Which, by the way, don't forget to send in your submissions to the Keg Tavern by email, and make sure you put tavern in there because it'll help me organize them.
And I should mention the best way to get our attention is, instead of just making an email, get a Bitcoin, write your stuff on the Bitcoin, and send us the Bitcoin.
Also, one of those sky writers will work too, you know.
Or a subspace transmission.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of a $20 bill, but you can't send that through the internet.
Write it on the back of a check, make it out the cash.
Okay.
That'd be a very black leather check if you made it out to cash. Johnny Cash.
Oh, well, yeah, if you're looking to monetize this, maybe Patreon would be something we'd want to look at. But at any rate, to Kavura, I am going to say Jolan Tru, and to our Klingon people, I want to say Kapla.
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 Jolan Tru.
And join us next time on the next edition of Bound by Honor,
where we prey on you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!